Is it really interesting to see how these companies are approaching Chicago, right?
She was telling me she's really trying to understand how the tech ecosystem here works.
What's interesting about the baby boomers is that they've never met a debt they didn't like.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
Welcome to Monday afternoon, everyone. Steve Bertrand in the Allstate Skyline Studio. Glad you're here for the Wintrust Business Lunch on this Monday afternoon. Philip Weiss will be here a little bit later to talk about the job market. You know, it's so hot that he said a lot more jobs now they're reducing the qualifications, or they're hiring people who don't necessarily have work experience in the field. Some of them are foregoing background checks, things like that. So, it can be good, can be bad. We'll talk to Philip about that later. Elise Glink will be here to talk about loaning money to family members. But right now, from Chicago Inno, Jim Dahlke and Catherine Davis are here to make their annual Oscar picks. Welcome to both of you.
Hey, Steve.
What's up, Steve?
I thought that was funnier. Not at all, huh?
Did you watch the Oscars last night?
I did, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you not?
I caught most of it, yeah.
Catherine?
Yeah. I only watched the first half. I had to go to bed early.
For the show?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, we're off to a rousing start. Let's talk about... Who wrote this story? Jim wrote this story about the Cubs owners, the Ricketts, buying into a sports betting company, the Action Network. It's not just the Cubs. It's a number of pro teams. And that kind of surprised me. I didn't think they'd be allowed to do that.
Yeah, it's really interesting the way that professional sports have cozied up to the legal gambling industry, right? So since last year, the Supreme Court ruling was overturned that not just Nevada can do sports gambling. So sports gambling is legal in 8 states currently, including New Jersey
Governor
and Pennsylvania.
Pritzker talked about it in his budget address last week.
So very soon here, Illinois could start to put some measures together where sports gambling could be legal in the state of Illinois, right? So it's very interesting to kind of see this news on the heels of that. So basically what the Ricketts family has done, along with a couple other sports ownership groups, actually for the Devils and the Philadelphia 76ers, have invested in this startup called the Action Network. So they were part of a $17.5 million round for this New York-based startup. And what the Action Network does is not so much a platform for gambling, but news, content, analysis, data to help people make better bets and track their bets in real time.
Right. And so, but so much about baseball and professional sports, I thought, was to protect its participants. I mean, ask Pete Rose, from being involved in gambling.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, gambling is, you know, the original sins of baseball, right? I mean, it's
the Black Sox.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, think about it. Like, it would be like, you know, if in a couple of years they started legalizing steroids in baseball, you know what I mean?
Right.
So it's actually fascinating. And it's the way there's kind of a mirror to the way marijuana legalization has gone to. You know, what do we do with all these people who've been like locked up in jail over minor marijuana possession? Now marijuana startups are everywhere. So
right.
It's sort of interesting to see that. But yeah, so basically what is happening both, you know, not just in baseball, but in other sports, is these pro leagues and pro teams are starting to say, hey, we might need to start investing a little bit more into this illegal gambling industry. Because if gambling is legal, you know, across the United States, then the pro teams are going to want to have a cut in this.
Well, Catherine, is there a risk of these teams getting involved in getting their hands dirty? I mean, there must be some safeguards.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you definitely get into some issues, you know, conflict of interest here, and, you know, what could go wrong down the line, but I think we'll just have to wait and see.
I don't know that there's going to be that big of a problem, right? Like,
right.
I think the tide is really shifting in favor of legal gambling. Now, I don't know exactly what that means, like, if you're going to be able to bet on games from your phone at the game, right? But you can already do that right now in New Jersey, for example, right? There's, like, a lot of online mobile gambling that you can already do. DraftKings allows
sure.
you to do that from your phone right now in states where it's legal. So,
But the companies that are being betted on or bet on aren't making money off of it, right? I mean, maybe I'm wrong. I could be completely wrong on this. But
so,
it seems to me like so, and we'll just use the Cubs because they're the one we're talking about. The Cubs will profit from people betting on them.
So that the X's and O's of this are going to be, we have to iron out over time, right? I don't think we have really a clear understanding of exactly who's going to be the winners and losers of this, but clearly sports ownership groups are seeing interest, at least from an investment side, from the VC perspective, and getting familiar with these companies that are operating in the space right now. So how exactly it'll look 5 years from now or 10 years from now, once gambling is legal and maybe the majority of the United States, we'll be kind of have to see down the road.
Maybe you could put it a different way. Maybe it would be like the Cubs or the Bears investing in Pro Football Weekly. I mean, people use different publications to garner information to bet.
Right.
Right. And that's what this new platform will do.
Right. Could be.
Okay, so there's that. Catherine, you wrote a story about that apparently you want to increase the cost that farmers have to pay to rent fields, farmland in this country.
Well, not quite increase it, but we wrote about Tillable, which is an ag tech startup here based in Chicago, and they just raised $8 million in funding. And basically what they do is they've created a platform for, you know, if you own some farmland and you want to rent it out to farmers, because, you know, you don't actually want to get out there and know, farm soybeans or whatever you're growing.
If you're Zsa, not, yeah, never mind, you wouldn't know.
This platform makes it easy to find those farmers and then also negotiate kind of fair rents for the land as well.
40% of the land, the farmland is rented. Is that, did I read that somewhere?
Yep. That's what Tillable says. And it sounds like, you know, they make $32 billion annually in rent, but that they leave $8 billion on the table because, you know, they don't always have access to resources on, you know, getting the most bang for their buck.
Right. So the landowners, the Tillable is saying the landowners are leaving money on the table, which means the renters, the farmers, that's what I was always saying, are going to end up paying more for rent, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the farmers can't be too happy about this idea.
Well, I think it's you're really opening up a brand new marketplace, right? So I think the idea is to make the whole process a little bit more transparent and equitable, right? So, I mean, I'm not sure exactly who the winners and losers are going to be, but what Tillable is able to do is basically kind of bring a tech platform to an industry that forever has not kind of had that infrastructure, right? What I kind of like about this startup is it's backed by a serial ag tech entrepreneur. So Corbett Culp founded a startup, 640 Labs, sold it a few years ago, basically was building kind of like an IoT hardware device for the agriculture industry, and now has a discovered a new problem in ag tech and has a new business. So kind of interesting to see the evolution of kind of his entrepreneurial journey.
And really it is, right? Because if you're selling farmland, you know what your neighbor sold the farmland for. It's public. It's public record. If you're renting it, you don't know.
Right.
So maybe you're overpaying in rent or underpaying, but this is a way to share that information.
Exactly.
All right, so let's go from there to, it looks to me like, well, is this the downtown high-rise apartments or college campuses where P&G now wants to do my laundry?
That's right. So P&G, I mean, you might not know this, but they have an on-demand laundry.
P&G being Procter & Gamble,
right, yeah.
The big boys, yeah.
So they have an on-demand laundry service, and they're expanding it nationwide. The interesting thing about that is they launched this service in Chicago. So it was called Tide Spin 3 years ago. They founded it in 1871, so in the tech incubator down in the Merch Mart. Really basically built this whole delivery network from a small team within the Merch Mart. So basically just kind of initially using Chicago as sort of a beta test market. You know, they liked it because there's, you know, a bunch of working millennials and people who could use a service like this. And now they're expanding it nationwide. By 2020, it's going to be all across the country.
And the idea is, I'm thinking of like a Goodwill box, right? You probably have a bag, you put your laundry in it and just drop it in a drop box?
Basically, it kind of like a locker system. So they're going to have different kind of drop-off zones. They're 24/7. It's all sort of app enabled, so you're telling them kind of how you want your clothes to be prepared, dropping the clothes off, and then they give you an alert when your stuff is done.
Why is a company like Procter & Gamble that makes and sells so many products getting involved with actually washing our clothes?
Boy, that's a great question, right? I mean, it's all about just maybe diversifying your revenue streams. I mean, one thing is, you know, Procter & Gamble has to compete with Amazon, right? So Amazon's going to deliver laundry detergent maybe to your house. Maybe Amazon has a service one day where it's doing its own laundry. So maybe they're getting a little ahead of the on-demand curve, right? Uh-huh. So they want to be able to sort of service the laundry customers in lots of different ways. And sort of this is one of those.
Did we talk, Catherine, on this show about it's being used more in Europe now, but it's unveiled where you will get your laundry detergent, your shampoo and stuff by subscription and reusable. You guys are both giving me blank stares, but there's this company and they were unveiled. There were several, like Procter & Gamble, I think, and others are investing in high-end dispensers for the shampoo. So rather than go out and buy new bottles of shampoo every month, like the milkman, you'll have your shampoo delivered and put it in this stainless steel dispenser. That doesn't sound familiar to you.
I haven't heard of that, but I kind of like that idea, especially as like you're kind of seeing different brands pop up. There's actually a brand or a company called Brandless, and they hold this whole thing around, you know, providing you whether it's shampoo or conditioner in a blank bottle, basically. Right. So you're not paying for the brand.
We've talked to them, I think. But this would be, they say it would cut down on pollutants because you would just have one bottle of shampoo. And I don't know if you'd get it in a plastic bag and you'd have to put it back in or not. I don't know. But they're doing it more in Europe and it's coming here and there were some big names behind it.
I like that idea. I mean, the hard thing with the subscription though is that like, I feel like there's not exactly like a easy calendar timetable of when I need this next
shampoo,
product.
It's
hard to say. It's like in dog food, for example. It's like it goes until it goes, and it doesn't always need it at the same time every month or every 2 months. So I think the subscription element of that is a little tricky if you are just sort of automatically getting it sent to your house.
You guys talked me into the Dollar Shave Club, and I've got razors all over my house now. That's Jim Dahlke, Catherine Davis from Chicago Inno. We're going to take a little pizza tour of the city of Chicago after a break. Catherine Davis and Jim Dahlke are in the studio from Chicago Inno. Okay, tomorrow at this, I guess we're already in the thick of voting with early voting, but tomorrow at this time, Chicagoans will be going to the polls to elect a successor to Rahm Emanuel, who was a very tech-friendly mayor, right? He gets high marks for that.
Oh, definitely. I mean, he, you know, a tech company in Chicago is opening a new office. He's there.
Right.
Big news when it comes to Chicago's smart cities. He's got a quote in the press release. Basically, if there was big tech news in Chicago, Mayor Rahm Emanuel was all over. He was speaking regularly at the Chicago Venture Summit. He has made himself very connected to the local startup scene.
Tech is the future. I mean, tech is everything, right? And any business is going to be tech-related. So there are 14 people running. Have you heard much in the campaign, Catherine, about tech in this campaign?
You know, not a ton. I think they've been focusing on a lot of other issues that are important to Chicagoans, but you could imagine that, you know, the candidates that are, you know, well-connected in the business arena would, you know, be champions of tech because, of course, you know, a lot of that has to do with, you know, big business and making sure that startups can connect with legacy corporations here in Chicago and Illinois. So, it'll be interesting to see who really is vocal about it in the coming weeks.
What do you hear, Jim?
Well, I know that we're going to have a chance. Actually, Chicago Inno will be moderating a mayoral forum next month with the two runoff candidates.
Nice.
And we're going to be able to chat with them kind of about tech forward issues. So it'll kind of be one of the first times that we take a really tech specific approach to some of these mayoral candidates. So I'm kind of excited to kind of hear where they're coming from. But right now, it's been a low-ish priority, rightfully so. You know, this is Chicago's big city, a lot of stuff going on. So it has not exactly been at the front of mind, I think, with a lot of these candidates. But I think it will certainly be a big issue going forward. I mean, with the job growth that comes with the technology industry.
Have you guys heard anything from anyone in the tech industry about it, that they're concerned or that they're looking at someone in particular?
I don't think so. I mean, it hasn't been necessarily one way or the other. I think from the people that I've spoken with recently, you know, they just want somebody who values technology the way the current mayor has, right? So they want somebody who takes technology as seriously and understands the value of it as much as Mayor Emanuel has. And so whoever comes out on top, they're hoping that the new mayor feels similarly.
Speaking of taking things seriously, Chicago takes pizza very seriously, and there's now a startup pizza tour. Familiar name, Steve Dolinsky, who is on, I've met his wife before. I know his wife's involved in this too, but is involved in food in the city, food tours and things like that. And they've started a weekend pizza tour?
Yeah, so Steve and his wife, Amy. Amy's a tech founder in the city, super plugged in with the startups around town. And yeah, basically they operate Pizza City USA, kind of as a side hustle. Basically they launched...
That's a smart side hustle,
yeah,
I think.
They launched this as really kind of a promotional tour for Steve's book. Steve went around and ate 185 different kinds of pizza around town and wrote a book about the best pizza. And they kind of used this bus tour and walking tour as kind of a marketing gimmick. And it actually turned into a pretty interesting little side business for them that they've continued to have beyond just the book promotion. So every weekend they run these bus and walking tours, taking people to places outside of the typical kind of commercial deep dish that you get around town, and really showing Chicago-style pizza.
Well, I will admit that I, for breakfast, had a piece of cheese Malnati somebody's pizza warmed up in the microwave. So I'm all for that. But Dolinsky talks about the out-of-the-way spots, right, that we might not know so much
He
about.
Wants you to go to the hole-in-the-wall places, the independent guys. You know, maybe you're not going to Giordano's, but you're going to Pizzeria Bibub or some of these other kind of smaller independent shops.
I like that he says Chicago style is really tavern pizza. You know, we don't think of that. We think of the stuffed pizza or deep dish, but there's nothing like a good slice, a little grease like forming in the pepperoni of a nice tavern style pizza. Right, Catherine? What's your favorite pizza?
Luminati's.
Okay, so the Dolinsky's do that. It's called, what's it called again?
Pizza City USA.
Pizza City USA. Check that out. Catherine, you have been touring sort of some of the tech offices and wrote a nice little piece about the design, because for these offices, it's all about design, right? Is there one company that's behind all these designs, or how is it that these companies come upon that?
Yeah, so there's kind of a couple, and I spoke to some of them. So one of them is a local firm here called Partners by Design, and they're behind tech offices like Peapod, Sprout Social, Braintree, the Tech Manufacturing Incubator, M-Hub, you know, and I talked to them a little bit about, you know, how do tech offices, you know, get these great offices? How do you, you know, right, really personalize them for them, you know, bring that tech forward, you know, aesthetic, but also making it like comfortable and homey for your employees.
And you have to make it flexible because they're, with any luck, they're going to grow, right? And they want to grow in that space.
Exactly. They said that oftentimes they see startups, you know, initially leasing spaces that are too large for the staff that they currently have, but the idea is that, you know, over time as they hire, they'll have room to put them.
Did the companies you talked to say that there really is a difference when it comes to tech offices than traditional offices?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we do our office envies all the time, right, and like you can really tell, you know, it's not just like your typical office space, or, you know, really kind of buttoned up, you know, kind of like boring office spaces. These, you know, Peapod, for instance, you know, they're a grocery delivery company, so they are really food focused. So they have like, you know, banana wallpaper in the office, and they have like an accent wall that's dedicated to, you know, the boxes they deliver their groceries in, and just sort of these, you know, unique things that I think make you want to kind of stay and work longer, right?
Read more at ChicagoInno.com or check out the Inno Minute on the Opening Bell every morning with Steve Grzanich right around 5:25. Jim Dahlke and Catherine Davis, thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks very much, David Jennings. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. Philip Weiss is in the studio. The president of WorkRight Solutions comes by from time to time. Philip, nice to see you again.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Okay, so well, tell me first, what are WorkRight Solutions? Tell me about the company.
Our company works with a lot of clients, as well as government agencies, to help make legal trends and policies simple, which is no easy task.
Right. When you think about it. You keep companies out of trouble.
Keep them out of trouble by turning what they should be doing and telling people into plain English.
And you sent me a note this week about, well, the job openings, I think, for, was it December or January, were 7.3 million. They'd set a record.
Since 2000, it's the highest.
Yeah. And you also pointed out, which is interesting to me, 41% of the new members of Congress who were elected in November are rookies when it comes to political experience. They've got no experience.
Yeah, and not that these two necessarily correlate directly.
Right, right.
I mean, in Congress, it's about fresh faces and new ideas. In corporate America, it's about maybe a warm body in a seat because you've got to get people employed.
And the employers are that desperate.
They really are. I think the word desperate is probably the best way to describe the certain mindset that we're seeing now. Companies are losing people. And companies are scared if they can't make hiring someone easy for the applicant and enticing, they're behind the eight ball.
And so what kind of jobs are we talking about here?
Well, remarkably, it crosses all industries. We saw it in tech a few years ago.
Sure.
But now it's pervading all levels and I should say virtually all industries. If you Google, for example, Steve, companies that no longer require a college degree
right.
for a job, it's everyone you've heard of. So everyone is changing the requirements and the barriers for new hires.
Which I think, well, in general, I think is a great thing. And we'll talk about some negatives of it. But, you know, we've talked about this sort of degree inflation where employers are requiring a college degree for jobs that don't really need a college degree, right? The people who are hiring them don't have a college degree. And that's really holding a lot of people back. So that's a good thing.
It is a good thing. In terms of, employers need to realize they should have been course correcting a few years ago. They shouldn't have been looking at the kind of academic attainment people had a decade ago and using that as a template. Now it's more about the job and what the job requires. But I think we've now, the pendulum has swung even farther in the other direction because of the need to fill these spots.
Right, so we've gone a little bit too far.
That's what we're beginning to see.
Now, I've never been to law school, but I did used to watch Owen Marshall when I was 10 years old.
Same, virtually the same thing.
Could I get a job at a law firm as a corporate attorney?
No. So, not that I know of.
No, let's hope not. Right?
I've known some lawyers that made me wonder if, in fact, that was the case. The reality is, the question today is, what jobs are left that require a college degree? And you've answered the question with your example. It's typically jobs, Steve, where then you have to go on and get an additional certification. Nursing, law, medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, it's almost an open field in terms of saying who is the candidate that gives us the skills that we need.
So you're telling me if someone wanted to get work at a public relations firm and they really don't have any experience in a public relations firm, there are firms out there now who will, well, they'll get to know the person, but they'll take the risk and make the hire.
Absolutely. And they'll, in some cases, perhaps in a rather risky manner, tell people, if you're good, you can be on a fast track for a manager job here, running a new team that's promoting a new product. So there's a lot of representations we're hearing that might be a little foolhardy looking forward.
Okay, so let's also talk then about criminal background checks, because you say that employers are so desperate or so in a hurry that they're foregoing the time it would take for a criminal background check.
Yes.
Now, I have been on the side of, I don't think a criminal conviction 20, 30 years ago should make you unemployable for life. So I kind of like that. We've also seen, you know, very clearly in just in Aurora where a more serious check might have been beneficial there. So how does a company balance that?
Yeah, the key is the word you use, which is balance. There's no question, Steve, that we have a trend of state and local laws that tell employers you can't outright disqualify someone, whether it's for an arrest and even in some cases for a conviction.
But if you're filling out an application, isn't that question always there still? Have you been convicted?
Well, we're seeing that question become a riskier part of the application.
Is that right?
So okay. That's a trend we're seeing as well. But the issue is, if employers themselves think, we're just going to do away with background checks, with drug and alcohol checks, you end up bringing people on board without even knowing anything about their background, enough to make a reasonable choice about whether you want to assume the risk of hiring them or saying no to them. And we dealt with a client recently where they brought a guy on board and they heard that other people were complaining that this guy seemed to be riding the elevator virtually all morning and all late afternoon long. As it turned out, he was looking for certain employees he had taken a shine to get to closer to them, get to know them better.
Right.
Only after the complaint surfaced over several weeks did the company find out this guy had two convictions for stalking.
Wow.
They didn't even have the chance to flag that information and have a discussion about whether this is the right candidate to put in an elevator.
So they didn't do the background check.
They used to, and because they wanted to make it easier for applicants, they did away with background checks.
And what if they had done the background check and they saw that he had stalking? That's an automatic no hire.
Well, not necessarily. It's the kind of thing that then you want to bring in the professionals.
Yeah.
Your in-house counsel, your outside counsel, HR, and say, all right, what do the laws tell us in our state? And even if the laws create a risk for us, do we want to balance that risk with the risk of hiring this person?
So sometimes you're saying, we're going to risk a lawsuit rather than risk bringing someone on.
Risk our employees' health, safety, and welfare, but companies should at least have the ability to make that judgment.
And you alluded to another story where there was a guy who worked in the cafeteria who had drug convictions.
That's right. So this is another great example of the barriers dropping and companies facing consequences later. This company did away with not only background checking, which is not uncommon now, but also with in-person hiring. So they didn't have a chance to evaluate this guy's demeanor.
So you can get a job now without ever showing up.
Sight unseen. Even some training is being done telephonically, or if you're lucky, by video.
Right.
So you're really rolling the dice in many cases. The dice were rolled in this instance, and the company missed the fact that this guy had numerous indications of drug and alcohol impairment.
Mm-hmm.
Not prescribed, unprescribed drug and alcohol, and alcohol usually is unprescribed.
Sure, right.
In any event, his work in a drug canteen, sort of a commissary at a remote location, resulted in numerous complaints about the quality of the food except for one item he created on his own, which was what he called the Special Wednesday Magic Muffins.
Yeah.
And I'm.
So he was lacing the muffins?
For certain employees who he was close to, he was creating a special batch of these muffins. So this company had no chance to even take that into account, and I think that would have been a disqualifier.
Okay, so we just have a little bit left, and one thing you suggest is bring on apprenticeships, right? Develop your workers that way.
Absolutely.
But background checks are background.
Don't do away with background checks unless you really know where that's going to lead you. As you said, Steve, it's really valuable to give people opportunities to learn about the company and let yourself learn about them. Apprenticeships and organizations that sponsor apprenticeships are a great way to start.
Any idea where we can get those magic muffins now, or are they pretty much...
They're all in evidence.
Philip
in the
Weiss
local police department.
Is the president of Work Right Solutions. Thanks for coming by, Philip.
Good talking to you.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. It's the most wonderful time of the year. Election time. The elections for Chicago's next mayor are tomorrow, and the race is still very tight. So when that's the case, knowledge is power. I've said it before and I'll say it again. Voting isn't what it used to be. So do your election research with two of my personal recommendations, Ballotpedia and Chicago's own Ballot Ready. You provide the info about where you're voting and then they lay out everything for you, including where all the candidates stand on big issues. Help yourself, help the city, and in turn, you'll help the business scene. But in the healthcare scene, there's a growing trend where design is shining bright. And Crane shined that spotlight on Swedish Covenant Health, where they're going, seemingly, over the top with incredibly well-designed spaces for patients with a $128 million rehab to their office and their lobbies, adding a touch of luxury to the healthcare experience. It might be a tough line to toe, though, because many people already struggle with their healthcare costs. And with these opulent trends, you've got to ask, will this help or hurt the image? I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thanks very much, Ori and Samuelson. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. On a phone line this afternoon is Elise Glink. You know her from Best Money Moves, a personnel app to help employers deal with their employees who are dealing with financial stress. Every week I describe it differently, Elise, but I think I got it that time, didn't I?
Absolutely, Steve. It's all good.
But the other thing is thinklink.com, and I get a newsletter from thinklink.com every Monday morning, and this morning was a column about whether or not or how to loan money to family members. And who was it? Benjamin Franklin said never a borrower or lender be. Was it Franklin?
He did say that, but he didn't live in a time where our millennial children are all overwhelmed with debt and unable to buy houses. At least many of them are. So he may change his tune right about now.
You know, I remember probably 20 years ago or maybe more when parents, instead of bailing their kids out for student loans, were helping them buy houses because that was the thing to do, you know, buy property right away.
Right. And it's true that parents are. Actually, let me back up and just say that people over the age of 50 increased the amount of student debt that they were accountable for by almost $30 billion last year. And what that tells me is that parents are now signing on for their kids' student loans.
Right.
And then if there's anything left, they're trying to help them in their 20s get started saving for a house and for moving out expenses by having them move home. So in the last 10 years, it's not like we haven't millennial kids live at home for 4, 5, 6 years after graduation.
And so when it comes to loaning the kids money, though, well, I guess there's a variety of different ways to look at it, right? But if you give them a big lump of it, I don't know what the figure is, but they would be responsible for paying income tax, right? If you just gift it out rather than loan it with some sort of interest rate.
Sure. I mean, a lot of accountants will call this phantom income because it's not really income, right? Somebody gives you a loan, but it's off the books, and you have to pay mom and dad back a little bit as you can over time. And the IRS may look at that and say, well, that's really a gift to you know, a gift under the parent's gift. Or.
Elise, are you there?
Can you hear me, Steve?
Yeah, you're breaking up a little bit. Try that again.
If it's a gift, that makes it very hard for the IRS to not, they either have to charge the parents or the kids end up paying tax on it.
Right. Can we try to, we're having trouble. We'll try to reconnect here with Elise. I'm going to cut her loose and see if we can get her back into talking about that. I'll tell you, the idea of borrowing money, I'm stuttering because I don't know how much to get into my own personal situation, but I think I've talked about it before. When Sharon and I, my wife and I, bought our first condo, we actually borrowed money from Sharon's grandfather. He was in the real estate business, but he set it up as a formal mortgage. He gave us a nice interest rate, but it was, you know, competitive, and it was nice just to have the money then borrowed from within the family. But, you know, and so if we'd gotten into trouble, I'm sure one thing or another we would have been taken care of, but the fact is it was a complete and formal mortgage that we were responsible for. At least I was just saying, I borrowed my first, my wife and I, our first mortgage together from a family member, but it was all strictly legal and written down, and that's pretty much the way to go, right? You got, if you're going to do it, you need to do it right.
Absolutely. We did the same thing. We signed a letter, which was actually a mortgage, and we paid interest every month. And then a year or so later, when we could qualify for super low interest rates, we refinanced, paid it off.
Yeah, and so, and isn't there something, too, that if you are the lender and you don't charge a fair interest rate, that you could end up being taxed by the IRS because they're looking at that as sort of income for you as well?
That's exactly right. They're looking at an arm's length transaction. That's their description of what they want to see, which is that your parents should charge you amount of interest that you might be able to get somewhere else on really favorable terms, but they want to see it documented and they want everybody to acknowledge that this is a loan and not a gift.
Right. And so, but I would imagine if you're in a situation where you need to borrow money and your parents lending your kids money, you're going to take the shortcut and not do that. And that's just sort of, well, it's just not good advice.
It isn't good advice. You need some sort of letter that acknowledges that you're going to pay what you're borrowing and what you're going to pay back every month and the rate of interest. It doesn't have to be anything more complicated than that. And you sign it, you give it to your parents, and you're all set. And that way, if the IRS then comes calling, you actually have something to show them.
It's also important to have something written down just in the case of death, right? If one of the parties should pass away, there needs to be some legal record of all of this.
That's right. I mean, if you're the only heir, I suppose it matters less, right? But
right.
If you've got siblings or other heirs, they're going to want to understand how that money's going to be repaid and who's responsible for it. Having it written and signed and documented is a really good start.
What is the number? Do you know off the top of your head of how much you can give to someone with it still being considered a gift?
I think this year it's $15,000 per person, which is great because mom and dad could give each child a gift of up to $30,000, 15 and 15. If you're married, they can also give your spouse 15 and 15. So you could get a tax-free gift from them that doesn't count against their gift tax exemption of up to $60,000, I think, this year.
And there'd be nothing wrong with my kids giving me a gift of $15,000 as well, right? Is that possible?
Anybody can give anybody $15,000.
In my case, my kids have to get that money first, I guess.
I guess so.
Elise Glink, thanks for joining us today. I know you're out of town on business, so I wish you great success.
Thanks, Steve. Talk to you next week.